on the second go around anyway. I don't know how I'm going to react when I go in to a closed MRI. Dick, I have other questions about a screwdriver antenna. Is now not the time?
Now we have the time, Lou. Rich, hang in there. Let's make sure that we've discussed as much as John wants to discuss about MRIs tonight. And I can see why, if there was any wiring left in your spinal column, the MRI operator would be very leery about that. For it could induce voltages into that wiring, and that wiring connected to your spinal cord can do some terrible things, if you know what I mean. KC2SHO, K2RIW, have any of your friends gone through MRI testing recently, John? You've got it, John.
NWS2N, question about this.
S2N recognized. Stand by. Go ahead, John.
Yes, a real good explanation, gentlemen. Thank you. The only other thought I had is, does the MRI leave the magnet on all the time, or do they kind of turn it off when you're moving? Do they switch it on and off? Is it constant? And then the difference here would be, in our environment, if you were to accidentally be in that room, although you have a button to hit on the wall and make sure you turn it off, the scram button, here we have it pulsed, so I wonder if the pulse would be a different, the same, obviously the reason for the problem I guess would be the same, but would the pulse then be more dangerous than just slowly moving through a static magnetic field? Go ahead, KC2SHO.
Now, when it comes to MRI machine turning on or off its magnetic field, absolutely not, John. That magnetic field is on all the time, steady state. To generate a 1.5 Tesla or a 3 Tesla magnetic field is a big deal. That's an extremely strong magnetic field. If you did that with an ordinary coil with current flowing through it, the IR resistance of the coil would create a huge power dissipation. Everything would run very hot. Therefore, they are forced to use superconducting wiring that maintains the current that's maintaining the magnetic field. So the whole coil is using superconductor wiring cooled with liquid nitrogen, liquid helium, and the liquid helium has to be in there boiling off continuously. So it's a big deal to charge that magnet. You don't want to discharge it. So the magnet is there 24/7, and you move the patient slowly into and out of that magnet. Now, the actual operation of the machine is there's another set of coils that are inducing an RF signal into you, which in some cases might be close to 400 megahertz, a pulse of signal, and the way that signal gets echoed by various portions of your body with a tomography-like system, they are able to get a three-dimensional picture out of it by the pickup coils at various angles around you. Let me drop. So 99% of that magnetic field is always there. A minor change to the magnetic field is done during the scanning process. Another set of coils makes a minor change to that, maybe at right angles. So that magnetic field has got to be there all the time with those superconducting magnets. And if you lose the cryogenics, if your liquid helium boils off and the system starts warming up, and that coil starts coming back down from that strong magnetic field, that discharge process is quite significant. There's a lot of stored energy there that has to be accommodated. So I suspect the average MRI machine is charged and kept charged for a solid year, is my best guess. I'm going to turn it over to Rich and then Paul in that order. W2, Bravo Zulu, have you heard things along those lines? Oh, no, I'm going to turn it over to Roy first. AC2GS, am I correct in assuming that you charge that magnetic field at the beginning of the year and you keep it charged for the whole year you're going to be using it? Is that true, Roy? AC2GS, K2RIW?
Yes, Dick, that's my understanding. You don't turn these things off and on. It's worse than unplugging something that's on, by a bunch of orders of magnitude. So it's on for the long haul unless or until you're doing maintenance on the MRI device. So the RF, it's a little bit more complicated than simply absorbing RF or not absorbing RF. If you didn't put the magnetic field, you wouldn't be able to interpret the RF reflections and such. You need to provoke it by forcing nucleuses of water and other atoms to be in a certain alignment, and then when the RF strikes it at the right frequency, it flips the magnetic domain, it dips the signal a little bit, and it gets interpreted on a two-dimensional computer program, and a radiologist who has spent years figuring this stuff out.
Somebody tried to give us a piece of information, but everything got clipped off. We'll turn it over to you in a second. The stored energy of that magnetic field is very significant. You have a very strong stored magnetic field in the superconducting magnets of the Large Hadron Collider. And when one of those magnets failed and that magnetic field came back down and discharged, it did a lot of damage. So the discharging procedure for all that stored energy in that magnetic field is a big deal. So charging it is difficult, discharging it is difficult, therefore you charge it and leave it charged at the 1.5 or 3 Tesla level with its superconducting coil, which is bathed in liquid helium to keep it at something like 3 degrees Kelvin to keep the superconducting occurring, to keep that magnetic field without loss of energy. We've got the new person who signed in, plus Paul. I'm going to go over Paul first. WS2N, you had a question, Paul. Go ahead, T2LAW in the TechNet.
Yes, I'm thinking about what John was saying. The electrons, or sometimes protons, flying around this unit, or sometimes it's a straight unit, a linear unit, but whatever, you're using magnetic fields to control the electrons or the protons. What makes the electron really magnetic, or the proton magnetic? I'm just thinking about, in a regular cathode ray tube for an oscilloscope or something, you'll have plates, and you'll just have, positive and negative plates. You don't have coils controlling the direction of where the electron's going. You're just using these plates. What makes these electrons magnetic? North pole, south pole, it's not like a string of atoms flying through it. We would have the domains. These things are just all by themselves, and yet they're magnetic. Back to you, Dick.
In order to get the curvature of the beam, to make it go into a circle, you're using a very strong magnetic field at right angles to that circle. If I understand correctly on Faraday's law, if, for instance, I have a strong magnetic field along the z-axis, and if I'm moving a charged particle, proton or electron, along the x-axis, I will develop a force at right angles, so that a strong magnetic field along the z-axis and a particle moving along the x-axis will create a force in the y-direction at right angles to both the motion and the magnetic field. So if I set up that magnetic field correctly on my Large Hadron Collider, the beam will get curved by the force in the y-axis, so to speak, and that makes the beam curve. You've got to have, compared to the velocity of the charged particle and the strength of the magnetic field, that all has to be balanced in order for the curvature to be right so that your beam stays in the middle of that tunnel. That's a very careful a tuning process. That's the reason why you don't start off with the signal on the Large Hadron Collider with the signal at zero and slowly speed it up. You use a series of smaller colliders. Let me drop the smaller set of accelerators bring the beam up in steps, so like shifting between first, second, and third gear, so to speak. So each one of your accelerators, the smaller machines, has a certain range of velocity over which it has the right magnetic field to curve the beam into the circle of that particular accelerator. And after you're finished doing the accelerator on the smaller machines, you dump the beam into the larger machine and continue the accelerating process. So I think that's Faraday's law. So a charged particle moving at right angles to a magnetic field develops a force in the third right angle field, and that's the method by which you you tune the beam, keep it in the right position, make it curve around that circle, and so on. There was a new person joining us. We didn't hear his call letters. Try once again, K2RIW in the TechNet. Squeeze the mic, wait a second before speaking.
Sorry, Dick, that was me, WB2GXM, Rich. I have a question. With all this intense magnetic field around an MRI, or for that matter, around a particle accelerator, how do they keep the magnetic field safely contained inside the room that it's supposed to be in, that it doesn't flood out into the rest of the building or out into the environment?
Somewhat similar to the way you build a 60-cycle transformer. The magnetic circuit inside of a transformer means that 99% of the magnetic field of your power transformer stays inside the transformer. Only 1% leaks on the outside because the air has a lot more resistance. The magnetic field flows through the iron of your transformer 100 times better than it flows through the air. So the magnetic field wants to be in that iron. It is my belief that inside of an MRI machine, there is the equivalent of an iron ring that the coil is wrapped around, and that magnetic field wants to be inside of that magnetic material. I suspect not very much of it leaks to the outside. However, when you're starting off with this huge magnetic field of 1.5 Tesla or 3 Tesla, even though a small percentage is leaking in the outside world, that amount of leakage to the outside world is so darn strong, so that if there was a steel oxygen bottle across the room, there was an example, for instance, that one of those got sucked into the machine, and I think a patient was there, and I believe the patient became heavily damaged, if not a lethal accident. So you got to be very careful about what's outside. Is that sort of your understanding, Roy, that you try to keep the majority of the magnetic field inside the machine by way of magnetic materials you've used to specialize in that manner? AC2GS, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, Dick, they use high mu shielding and other such things. I mean, thankfully, as we all know Maxwell's equation, the magnetic field, the diversion of a magnetic field is equal to zero. So it all comes back on itself as opposed to electrical fields. And so if you properly mu shield a magnetic field, you can trap most of it inside a container, if you will. And that's what they generally do. And the way I tend to like to think of things, and maybe I'm a little strange, a charged particle stationary just produces electric field. A charged particle at a constant velocity produces a magnetic field at a right angle. A accelerating charged particle produces an electromagnetic field. So, you know, if they're basically Faraday's laws stated more commonly.
So an accelerating machine like the Large Hadron Collider can keep in a curved path charged particles like electrons and protons, but an uncharged particle like a neutron will not have this effect. I think you cannot accelerate neutrons directly in an accelerating machine like a Large Hadron Collider. Is that true, Roy? You could not accelerate neutrons all by themselves in that machine, is my belief. AC2GS, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Absolutely, Dick. And that's why there basically are two primary types of colliders. Initially, when they build a ring, they make an electron-positron collider. And then after a while, and they've gotten a lot of information from that, they switch it over, they upgrade it, and they switch it to protons, either two protons banging into each other or a proton and an antiproton. Or sometimes they can play with ions, so very small ionized nucleuses, and that's how you can sort of experiment with neutrons. As long as there's a proton in the nucleus in an ionized species, it has a charge and can be accelerated around a ring. And initially, accelerators use DC currents to do these things, but now, as I'm sure John can tell you, they're using radio frequency signals to modulate the acceleration through the ring.
I'll see if John has any further questions or comments on all of the above. KC2SHO, K2RIW for any further questions or comments. You've got it, John.
Oh, there goes my dryer. Oh, very good, guys. Really great information, and will definitely send me down probably reading some more. One thing I would like to say would be that I do believe they still make accelerators in both flavors, magnetic and RF. I think if you look at the DART, I think it's DHART here at Los Alamos, that is a magnetic accelerator, and there are other ones in the process too, from what I understand. But I believe there's different reasons for why they build them, although I can't tell you that here and now. I'd have to read up some more on that myself. But thanks for that info. Great great conversation, guys. K2RIW, KC2SHO.
Very fine, Josh. Anybody have any further questions or comments for the... Oh, yes. I think it was Lou, NY2H, who had an antenna question. NY2H, go right ahead, Lou.
This is Rich, W2BZ.
Okay, you got it, Rich.
A couple of quick comments on MRI. Unfortunately, I have way too much experience having MRIs. And I'm sure, you know, they have to keep the machine energized at a certain level. But the decibel level during a 25-minute test sure changes greatly, maybe four or five times. And I guess that's when they're actually moving the machine and then going in, you know, for a deeper picture. Would that be true, Roy?
Well, yeah. I mean, they're moving the detectors. It's basically an RF emitter and an RF detector, and they have to swing that around to get a two-dimensional perspective of what they're imaging.
Always wondered what that was. The other thing, question for you, Roy, is I have a lot of back pain, as you know, and it's when I'm sitting, I am virtually out of pain, and when I'm standing, I could be instantly in horrific pain. And there are now standing MRIs, and it just seems to me those would be a more accurate test of what's going on with me, because as I stand up, you know, my spine is getting loaded up with, you know, a hell of a lot more energy than when I'm sitting down. And so I'm wondering why standing MRIs aren't the status quo now.
Well, I mean, it's an interesting thought. Usually the type of imaging that they do doesn't really require any kind of position that I'm aware of. You know, they don't really have it such high resolution where you can see little gravitational effects and sagging and such. Although, you know, they're trying new things, and they'll see how useful and how expensive they are and figure it out. It took a long, long time for open MRIs to come into being because it costs a great deal more than the closed type, but it benefits a lot of people. It's very, very common to feel rather claustrophobic in those places. So I'm not quite sure whether standing MRIs have proven to be terribly different in effectiveness over the standard model. Time will tell.
It's my understanding that the open MRIs are not as precise, can't get as fine a picture as the closed MRIs. Is that true, Roy?
Well, I think they cut a couple of corners. I don't know if theoretically there's a limitation or it's an expense. It's far easier to kind of maintain a more stable magnetic field and such in a more enclosed environment than an open one. I'm sure if money was no object, they could probably bring it up to specs, but they probably feel that the cost-benefit ratio doesn't quite work out that well. But, you know, they're capable of very high resolution.
Hey, Dick, a couple of quick antenna questions and maybe one not-so-quick one. I am in ham radio hell in a condo community here where nothing is allowed on the roof, or there's no access to the attic, or I guess to the common attic. I have a solution, which is putting my screwdriver antenna, excuse me a second, screwdriver antenna on my vehicle, on my Kenwood 440, in my house, and running it like that. The combination of my Kenwood 440 and the screwdriver is proven, because I've worked the world, albeit with better propagation than now, with that combination. My first question is, would an artificial ground in this situation do...
Lou, you got cut off. We heard you say wood and artificial ground, and then we heard nothing beyond that. Want to complete that question, Lou, in Y2H, KQLIW?
It's W2BZ, and it's Rich, like the 10 other Riches on the repeater. My question is, with a screwdriver mounted on my car, running a coax into my place, into my living room, into a Kenwood 440, would an artificial ground be of any benefit at all in this situation?
If you speak to a number of HF operating amateur radio operators, I'm pretty sure you're going to get two different answers on that one there, Rich. I am guessing that your apartment might be a two-floor apartment. I am guessing that your automobile is driven into the garage at the ground floor, and that can work pretty well, but there are various antennas you could build which could be operating on an upper floor if you do have more than one floor of your residence, and the extra altitude might give you some benefit. Now, the word ground, an RF ground on an antenna, is a controversial subject. Various amateurs think ground is very important. In the case of a quarter wave vertical, for instance, the so-called counterpoise, that ground is very important. If the radiator happens to be a half-wavelength type radiator, then ground is not important at all. I mean, a dipole held in the hands of an astronaut who is floating in space 150 miles above the Earth, he has no local ground, but that antenna works like a charm because it's a fully symmetric antenna with a half-wavelength. If the antenna electronically is a half-wavelength, then I think ground is not required. And there are various kinds of vertical antennas you can put on an automobile that are half-wavelength style, and there are kinds that are quarter-wavelength style. So you've got a number of things to play with here. Altitude of your abode and kind of antenna that you're using, and whether or not ground makes a difference. And I know that's not a direct answer, but that's some of the variables involved, to my knowledge, Rich. W2 Bravo Zulu, K2LAW in the TechNet.
My situation is a ground floor. There's nothing above me except an attic, which I can't get to, unfortunately. And my car would be backed up to my spot right in front of my door, about 25 feet away. And that's where I'm running the coax from the 440 into the screwdriver antenna. So that's the situation, and as opposed to being on a second story. My other question is, let's say I can get get the SWR down with my internal antenna tuner in the Kenwood 440, let's say to 2-to-1. If I run the output of that of the transmitter of the 440 into an MFJ, I have an MFJ tuner. Would that give me quote unquote a false positive, or might that be beneficial and bring down the SWR to 1-to-1, let's say?
Right now, you didn't make it clear, Rich, where is the antenna tuner located? If the antenna tuner is located in the house and you're feeding the 25 feet of coax cable, you're going to experience a significant amount of extra loss of that cable. If the antenna tuner is a remote tuning type right at the automobile, then the antenna tuner will do beautiful work and it won't be a false positive. So you can get a false positive of hunky-dory if the antenna tuner is in the house and if the antenna has a high enough ISWR. So whenever there's a high standing wave ratio on the antenna, it's reflecting a lot of signal. And if that signal is being reflected back to 25 feet of cable into the antenna tuner in the house, then you will get a false positive in that case. Is that a little bit more clear, Rich? W2BZ, K2RIW?
Getting the SWR down with the internal antenna tuner with the MSJ 3 feet away in the house, then running the 25 feet out to the screwdriver antenna, that will give me that false positive and of no benefit.
The antenna tuner is still giving you benefit, without a doubt. It's not giving you as much benefit as you like. If, for instance, your antenna had a 5.5 to 1 standing wave ratio, for instance, that's the case where half the power is reflected. Half the power reflected back down the 25 feet of cable, hits the antenna tuner, and the majority of the power gets re-reflected forward. So your power is now bouncing back and forth multiple times on your 25 feet of cable if you had that high a standing wave ratio. And you are going to get a hell of a lot of extra loss because your signal is going to the cable multiple times before it finally gets radiated. As such, whatever you can do at the antenna to lower its ISWR at the antenna at your desired frequency is going to make your situation the best. The internal antenna tuner, in the worst case, ISWR is going to give you a false positive. There are various ways you can retune and rematch your screwdriver antenna to make a good match at the car before you proceed. I recommend you do that, Lou. Rich. W2BZ, K2RIW.
Okay, so in this instance, an internal, so one antenna tuner in the Kenwood 440 going into the MFJ tuner 2 feet away, then into the 25 feet of coax, won't buy me anything. I know about, remote antenna tuners. I looked at the prices of, what is it, SGW or, the big one, the big manufacturer, and boy, they are expensive. Go ahead.
Hey, CJ.
Okay, Eric, you're going to give us some information. I'm also going to be asking what's the reason that channel 5253 and 923 and 4 are off the air. K2EJ, K2IW, go ahead, Eric.
K2IW, K2J. My question is, if you've got a screwdriver antenna, why in God's name would you want to put a tuner in the line? I mean, that's the whole point of a screwdriver antenna. That's my question.
I've done, in the past, when the rig was in the car, is I would first tune, the screwdriver to as resonant as I could get it, and then, I guess the word is tweak it with the internal 440 antenna tuner. What I think I'm hearing is that is not needed and won't buy you anything. That's what I was talking about, Eric. Go ahead.
Rich, with your screwdriver tuning procedure, what's the lowest standing wave ratio you could get with the barefoot screwdriver before using an antenna tuner? How bad was the ISWR with just the screwdriver tuning itself? Over to you, Rich.
Not bad at all. I get it down to 1.5. Maybe I was shocked, but that's with the rig in the car, 3 feet from or 4 feet from the antenna.
Okay, once you properly calibrate the system, whether the rig is 3 feet from the antenna or 30 feet from the antenna, the ISWR on the antenna stays the same, if you know what I mean. What you indicate for ISWR will require some correction. But the the Vislar of the antenna does not change as a function of the length of the transmission line. So if your screwdriver can be tuned for a 1.5 to 1 standing wave ratio, you're in like Flynn, and you almost don't need an antenna tuner at all, no matter where the antenna tuner is located. Does that make some sense, Rich? W2BZ, K2LIW?
It does. You know, I've never done this with, you know, using the car and the screwdriver as an antenna for, you know, quote-unquote base station. I'll report back next week and tell you what my actual readings are and, you know, what I'm looking at in real life. The last question I have, Dick, and this may be too much for now, but I was wondering the other day, in terms of ham radio antenna design, UHF, DHF, HF, have all designs so far known? Are they all that will be known, or can some design out of left field take the ham radio world by storm, if you know what I mean? Or do we basically have it at this time and place? Go ahead.
Comment on the previous subject when you're done.
Okay, we'll go to a comment on the previous subject in a minute. In my opinion now, Rich, there are something like 5,000 kinds of antennas. And if you're a member of the IEEE Antennas and Propagation Society, of which I'm a senior life member, many of the issues in the back will show you the brand new antenna patents that were issued in the last couple of months. And quite often those issues will have 5 or 10 new antenna patents. So you could say new antennas are being invented all the time. Now, do the new antennas use a brand new law of physics? Probably not. In many cases, there are new physical embodiments of a particular antenna type. But have we heard the last word on the best possible amateur antennas? Absolutely not. I don't say that you're going to get a new one every week, but there's going to be new antennas invented. They always are being new ones invented. There's no end to it. There's a zillion different ways you can do it. And by the way, there's two basic antenna types, direct and inverse. In other words, the average antenna you and I use, let me drop. The average antenna we use, at least at HF frequencies, is a conducting object in free space. There's a whole class of antennas which are the opposite of where all of free space is conductive and you put a slot in it, so-called slot antennas. Every single antenna that you know of, it's possible to make a slot version of it. So of the 5,000 kinds of antennas, there's another 5,000 out there that could be built in some cases. Who was it that wanted to add something to the previous subject? Give me a call. That is the name once again, K2LIW.
K2SHO, John.
Go right ahead, John.
As Rich was, I always got to remember to leave a blank there. As Rich was discussing his idea there, the idea to run a coax out to the truck, I immediately thought, now he may not have radios compatible with this, but if he did, or if he wanted to make the investment, you know, they make radios now that are IP controllable. You could put a power supply, a switch network in the car just to, you know, not run the car battery down, maybe. And with an extension cord and a Cat5, you know, Ethernet cable, whatever you want to call it, completely remote control the car radio from your laptop inside the house. And then you kind of bypass the need to run the coax out to the car, and you just run the car remotely, if you will. I hope that's clear and makes sense, but, you know, just like the systems now where you can rent the radio and use it from your local computer, you could set up your own radio via IP and control it from in the house. K2RW, KC2SHO.
What about a Wi-Fi connection?
Yeah, his radio out in front of his residence could be a remote base. There's various ways you could do that. But he doesn't have to go that elaborate, in my opinion. If he knows he's going to be operating on the low end of a 20-meter band, and by whatever means, temporarily puts a radio in the car, or by whatever means, he tunes his screwdriver antenna to give a 1.5-to-1 standing wave ratio at the low end of the 20-meter band. Then he goes back into the shack with the 30 feet of cable, 25 feet of cable, and operates the low end of the band. So if he knows ahead of time what frequency he's going to be on, he has the ability to give a good standing wave ratio at the antenna. And that's the important part. The fact that you can correct the apparent VSWR in the shack with one or two antenna tuners in the shack can give you a false positive. It'll give you a warm, fuzzy feeling that you got a low VSWR, which is phony. You're still driving 25 feet of cable with a high standing wave ratio at the far end. You've got to kill the high standing wave ratio at the far end. Does that make some sense, Rich? W2BZ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
My instinct was that I would be getting false positives. And I go, oh, wow, look at that. Look at that needle come down. But I just felt instinctively, or maybe over the years I've been in ham radio, that it would be a false positive. I came up with that phrase. I don't know if I've ever heard it in a discussion about antennas, but I'm glad it was corroborated. Well, in a way, I'm glad. And in a way, I'm not. I'll report back next week and give you the actual numbers, and I will be operating on the low end of all the bands because I'm just interested in operating CW, not phone. So, excuse my voice, guys. I'm coming on with something a little bit, but thanks, Dick, for your help. So, Whiskey 2, Bravo Zulu.
Yeah, Rich, I'm going to make it a little bit more easy to understand why the false positive exists. And false positive, your words for it, are very good words. The way an antenna tuner works is that it recognizes the fact that a poorly tuned antenna, the signal that flows down the cable that hits the antenna, only a portion of the signal is accepted by the antenna because the antenna is improperly tuned. The antenna itself is reflecting a certain amount of signal back down the cable. What an antenna tuner does is it presents exactly the right impedance at the shack so that the signal reflected back down the cable gets re-reflected forward in phase with the signal your transmitter is making right now. And it does that reflection at the output connector of the antenna tuner. So right at the output connector of the antenna tuner, your signal being reflected from the antenna gets re-reflected forward toward the antenna. Therefore, in the shack, you don't see that reflected signal. And you properly called it a false positive. And because you don't see it, you think everything's hunky-dory. You've got to correct the antenna impedance right at the load end of your transmission line, right at the far end. So you've got to tune the screwdriver for the frequency of desired operation. And when you do that, you almost don't need an antenna tuner at all. Does all that make a little more sense now, Rich? W2 Bravo Zulu, K2RIW on the TechNet.
That's what Eric was saying, you know, especially with the screwdriver antenna, as opposed to a Hustler, mono band or, one band type of antenna. No, it's crystal clear now. And as I said, I'm glad I now, you made it absolutely understandable, but a little disappointed, especially with my two antenna tuners, one in the rig and then the external one in the shack, not making sense either. Well, next week, like I said, I'll know full well how this comes, how the real numbers are looking next week at this time. So thanks, Dick, and everybody else. Whiskey 2, Bravo Zulu.
Is there anybody with any further questions or comments on any of the subjects up till now? Give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW.
Yeah, K2RIW, WB2CLN. Hello there, Dick. Got a question. Go ahead.
Okay, WB2CLN. I'll please start off with your name and then your question. Go right ahead.
Yeah, name is Tom. I'm in Flushing, I think, and I've known you for many years, more off than on, but anyway, the question is, I have to get a couple of radios, a low-band transceivers repaired. And the guy who used to do it for me is indisposed, we'll say that. Do you know anybody in New York City or western part of Long Island, Nassau County, that can repair like a Kenwood TS-2000 and a Kenwood TS-690S? Go ahead.
Yes, Andy. W-H-U-C-D-L. Commercial driver's license. Andy, W-H-U-C-D-L, can either do it or recommend somebody who can do it for you. If you listen to this repeater a few times during the day, you will hear Andy on. He's the guy who runs the tune-up clinic at each one of the Limelight get-togethers. So I would start off with Andy. He can either do it directly for you, or he can suggest somebody who can do it for you. Is that a QRZ, Tom? WB2CON, K2RIW?
Yeah, you mean WA2CDL? Give me that call again. You don't mean WA2CDL, I think it is, right?
QRZ, you got it right. Andy Kirschenbaum, WA2CDL, commercial driver's license. He can either do it directly for you, or he can suggest somebody for you who can do it. Back to you, Tom.
All right, very good. Thank you. And I heard about that from someone else on LimeMark here. So, all righty. The guy who used to repair it, to say, is indisposed. You could probably guess who it is. Anyway, how are you doing there, Dick? And Happy New Year to you. And you still have these tremendous VHF antenna arrays? Go ahead.
Yes and no. My great big array of 16 Yagis is no longer up in the air on 432. But the towers are still standing, and the operation proceeds. The technical net is now 1982. We've been doing it for 36 years, 36 and a half years. So looks like there's always more guys joining ham radio, and always new questions on transmitters, antennas, and tuners, and transmission lines, and so on. It never ends. Okay, it's time we now go over to the second portion of the technical net, which is Roy, AC2GS, who's got some interesting questions and puzzles and subjects to discuss tonight. So here comes the science talk portion of the tech net. AC2GS, Dr. Roy. K2RIW, you got it, Roy.
Thank you very much, Dick. I was going to say it in Morse code just because of what Lou said earlier, but I thought it would be too long of a joke. As always, if anyone has any topics, if anyone has any questions, if anyone has any statements to refute what I say, and it's easily refutable, it's the email address available is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. Everything that I talk about pretty much will also be available as links to articles and in the case of YouTube videos, the YouTube videos on a page. You open your browser and you type roy.ac2gs.com, and that will give you a link page to many of the subjects that I am talking about tonight and that I've talked about before. And already posted on there, I saw a very interesting sharp image of MU-69, better known as Ultima Thule. So I've posted the new image from New Horizon. It was taken January 1st of this year at 12:26 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. So if you go to that page, you'll see a very nice, sharp picture of Ultima Thule. Let me drop. Before I go to the stuff that I prepared for tonight, I thought that I might talk about something earlier mentioned at the very beginning of the TechNet. I believe KC1SAM and Dick were talking about taurine. Taurine is an amino acid. Amino acids are the building blocks of proteins in human life, in all life. Human beings have 20 different discrete amino acids. We are only able to produce about 12 of them. 8 of the amino acids we have to absorb from animals who can synthesize it. And the funny thing about taurine, we can synthesize taurine. We don't need to eat things with taurine. Dogs don't need taurine. They can synthesize it, but cats can't. So that's why cat food tends to be high in taurine, because they need an external source of those amino acids. So that's my little 2 cents worth on taurine and the 20 amino acids that make up all the proteins of our body. Let me drop for any questions or comments. Also, we ended a little early last week because of the red wolf moon, the super red wolf moon, and someone actually left a question in the chat room after we had all shut down for the night. His question was, do we have any functional Earth-facing cameras either on the moon or in lunar orbit that during the lunar eclipse might be able to capture a lunar-based solar eclipse and or a view of the corona? It's sort of an interesting question. The problem is that we're kind of spoiled. When we have a solar eclipse, the position and size of the moon and the sun from our perspective is just so happens to kind of coincide, and the moon beautifully blocks the sun and not much else. That isn't the case for the Earth and the sun when there's a lunar eclipse. So you're not going to see that beautiful corona. You're just going to see a big blob of the Earth covering every aspect of the sun behind it. So it's an interesting question, and it goes to show that we kind of think in terms of our privileged position in the solar system, that the moon and the sun have the same relative size due to their own size and their distances from us. Let me drop for any questions or comments.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
The only camera out there on a satellite would be the Discover satellite that's at Lagrange Point 1. So it's a million miles away from us in the direction of the sun looking back toward Earth. So as the moon goes, you know, as the Earth passes in front of the moon, the camera might be able to pick up, you know, part of the eclipse, but then, like you said, once the Earth completely covers it, I think it's 400-1 the ratio or something, it's going to be gone. But, you know, it might be able to pick up the moon with a partial eclipse before the Earth completely blocks off. Then all that camera would see is the Earth. That satellite was put out there by SpaceX quite a few years ago. Back to you, Howard.
Thank you, Paul, for that information. I can imagine that it would. But, again, the problem is if you looked at it, you'd kind of say, well, so what, unfortunately? We're kind of jaded. We used to these beautiful images of the sun's corona when the moon is covering it up in silhouette. And you wouldn't get any of that effect, I would think. You would just get you'd see the sun behind the Earth, and it would just go away. You could probably mimic the same exact thing from all kinds of different angles, because the sun regularly goes behind a part of the Earth. So, it wouldn't be quite that special, unfortunately. Okay, on with the show. It's getting dangerous being a science researcher these days. A group of Indian scientists recently got blown up due to a laboratory experiment gone terribly wrong. A Chinese geneticist is still under house arrest, sweating criminal charges that can end in a possible death sentence. And now it seems that it's a tough time to be a cranky old Nobel laureate. The Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory has stripped James Watson, the 90-year-old Nobel Prize-winning scientist, famous for determining the double helix structure of DNA with his partner, Francis Crick, in the 1950s, based on research conducted by British chemist Rosalind Franklin, of all his honorary titles after the laboratory deemed his recent remarks on race reprehensible, according to CNN. Watson has long expressed questionable views, including a 1997 interview in which he expressed unreserved support for abortion rights. Now, that's something that might have been relatively uncontroversial had he not specifically mentioned fetuses determined to have hypothetical genes leading to such things as homosexuality, dyslexia, or even the lack of musical or sports talent as valid reasons to terminate a pregnancy. But it's his remarks on that have drawn the most scorn, such as a 2007 interview with a British journalist in which Watson said he is inherently gloomy about the prospect of Africa due to a debunked research allegedly showing racial gaps in intelligence, per the New York Times. In that interview, he also said that he wished racial equality was real, but, quote, people who have to deal with black employees find this not true. Watson apologized, though the incident ended in his semi-forced retirement as chancellor of the laboratory, and later his decision to sell his Nobel Prize. Let me drop for a second.
Repeater, timeout.
Sorry about that. However, the laboratory's decision to revoke Watson's honors and titles is the result of an American Master's Decoding Watson, a PBS documentary that aired earlier this month, and you might want to check it out. It's for free on the Internet. In that interview, Watson said that his views had not changed, and he had not seen any knowledge negating his belief that there is a genetic connection between race and intelligence, the Times wrote. He also said he took no joy in the difference between blacks and whites and that it's awful just like it's awful for schizophrenics. By the way, one of Watson's sons has been diagnosed with schizophrenia. Watson's views on race are not only scientifically unsupported. The National Institute of Health director, Dr. Francis Collins, told the Times he was unaware of any credible research from which Watson could have come to such a profoundly unfortunate conclusion. He keeps expressing them at a time when racial pseudoscience is on the upswing. Let me drop for a second. For CNN, while Watson had already been relieved of his administrative duties, Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory has now moved to strip him of all remaining honorary titles. The laboratory said, quote, it unequivocally rejects the unsubstantiated and reckless personal opinions Dr. Watson expressed, noting the statements were reprehensible and unsupported by science. According to The Guardian, the revoked titles include Chancellor Emeritus, Oliver R. Grace Professor Emeritus, and Honorary Trustee. Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory President Bruce Dillman and Chair of the Board of Trustees, Marilyn Simon, said in a statement last Friday that the views expressed in the PBS documentary amount to a retraction of Watson's prior apologies and require the severing of any remaining vestiges of his involvement. Let me drop for a second. Dr. Watson has not been involved in the leadership or management of the Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory for more than a decade, and he has no further roles or responsibilities there. Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory acknowledges and appreciates Dr. Watson's substantial scientific legacy, including his role as founding director of the Human Genome Project and his critical leadership in the development of research and education at the laboratory during his prior tenure as director and president. Nonetheless, the statements he made in the documentary are completely and utterly incompatible with our mission, values, and policies and require the severing of any remaining vestiges of his involvement. Let me drop for a second. As British geneticist Adam Rutherford argued in 2014 when Watson complained in an interview that the scientific community had shunned him, it revealed a pernicious character entirely unrelated to his scientific greatness, and that is long-standing, not new. Watson and Crick's key evidence in their study, Photo 51, was produced by Franklin and her graduate assistant, Ray Gosling, at King's College London and secured without Franklin's knowledge or authorization via her supervisor, Morris Wilkins. Franklin never received the Nobel Prize, as she died in 1958, 4 years before the others received theirs. Rutherford noted that in Watson's 1968 book, The Double Helix, Watson referred to Franklin by the nickname Rosie, despite there being no evidence that anyone ever did that, and wrote mean-spirited appraisals of her physical appearance. Let me drop for a second. In 2018, the National Academy of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine issued a report on gender harassment in science, which Science Mag used as an opportunity to discuss Watson's condescending writings on how Franklin's belligerent moods supposedly interfered with Wilkins' ability to maintain a dominant position that would allow him to think unhindered about DNA, as well as that she had to go or be put in her place. The magazine also noted that Crick was quoted in the 1993 book Nobel Prize in Science as admitting, quote, "I'm afraid we always used to adopt, let's say, a patronizing attitude towards her," end quote. Gee, I wonder what people today would have made of fellow Nobel laureate William Shockley. The only thing that saved that guy's reputation was his death in 1989. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, talking about Nobel Prizes and the honored Nobel Prize laureates, it's not frequent, but not that rare, for different family members to win their own separate Nobel Prizes. The Curie family set the record with 4 separate Nobel Prizes amongst 5 members of this illustrious family. There have been brothers, brother-in-laws, husbands and wives, and fathers and sons who have been so honored. But the pair that interests me personally the most is J.J. Thompson, born in 1856, died in 1940, who was credited with the discovery and the description of the electron, for which he received his Nobel Prize in Physics in 1906, and his son George Thompson, who was born in 1892 and died in 1975, who received his own Nobel Prize in Physics in 1937. Let me drop for a second. Two separate Nobel Prizes for 2 separate fundamental discoveries. J.J. Thompson's Nobel Prize was for his discovery that electrons were charged particles. He preferred calling them corpuscles rather than the name saved by others that we use today, the electron. So the question, my little puzzle for tonight, gentlemen, is any idea what his son's original discovery was and how J.J. might have taken to that son's discovery. So anyone with any ideas the reason why J.J.'s son George got his particular Nobel Prize?
WS2N.
That's Paul.
I have no idea, but if you're saying Thompson, maybe it's the machine gun.
I think the Thompson machine gun came before any of George's great inventions. I don't know, maybe it was a black sheep of the family, but I think actually the Thompson machine gun might have been an American invention. I'm not sure. These guys are from England.
Yeah, I don't think they give a Nobel Prize out for a weapon of mass destruction. Although I think Nobel, wasn't Nobel the guy who invented the dynamite?
Paul, there's a great story on that Alfred Nobel invented dynamite, made a fortune, and unfortunately, or fortunately, at one point or another, the newspapers got confused and thought he had passed away, and published an obituary calling him all kinds of terrible things, that he was the death bringer of so many people. And it really upset him, and he decided to make amends by setting up the Nobel Prizes, including the Nobel Peace Prize. So, yeah, I think the last thing that the people running the Nobel Prize would give a Nobel Prize to is something that directly kills a bunch of people. A lot of science, unfortunately, leads to death and destruction, but it's not the primary reason for it. But, yeah, that's a great story for Alfred Nobel.
KD2IBP.
Very good, okay. I hear another station. Pick them up, Roy.
KD2.
Yes, KD2IVP.
Had stabilized nitroglycerin. Nitroglycerin was very unstable, very heat and impact sensitive, and it actually killed his brother in the production of it, and he learned how to have it absorbed in diatomaceous earth to try to stabilize it, easier to use for industry.